Even at the distance of a century, there's been no war that seemed more terrible than World War I. In the 4 years between 1914 and 1918, this war killed or wounded more than 25 million people, and for less apparent purpose than did any other war before or since. Yet there were still some odd moments of joy and hope in the trenches of Flanders and France, and one of the most remarkable came during the first Christmas of the war. There was a few brief hours during which men from both sides of the Western Front laid down their arms, emerged from their trenches, and actually sit down to share food, carols, games, and comradeship. Now this truce, their famous Christmas truce, was both unofficial and illicit. Many officers, well, they disapproved. Headquarters from both sides took really strong steps to ensure it would never happen again. But while this truce lasted, the truce was magical, leading even the sober Wall Street Journal to observe, quote, "What appears from the winter fog and misery is a Christmas story, a fine Christmas story, that is, in truth, the most faded and tattered of adjectives, inspiring." Now, the first signs that something strange was actually happening occurred on Christmas Eve, 8:30 p.m. An officer with the Royal Irish Rifles reported to headquarters that, quote, "The Germans have illuminated their trenches. They're singing songs and they're wishing us Happy Christmas. Compliments are being exchanged, but I'm still nevertheless taking all military precautions." Now, further on down the line, the two sides serenaded each other with carols. The Germans sang Silent Night, being met with the British chorus of The First Noel. Then, scouts met, cautiously, in no man's land, you know, the shell-blasted wasteland between the trenches. The war diary of the Scots Guard records that a certain Private Merker met a German patrol and was given a glass of whiskey and some cigars, and a message was sent back saying that if we didn't fire at them, they would not fire at us. Now, that same basic understanding seems to have sprung up really spontaneously at other spots and other battlefields. For another British soldier, Private Frederick Heath, the truce began late that same night when, all down our line of trenches, there came to our ears a greeting unique in the war. English soldier, a Merry Christmas." Then, as Heath wrote in a letter home, the voices added,
"For some little time, we were cautious and did not even answer. Officers, fearing treachery, ordered the men to be silent. But up and down our line, one heard the men answering that Christmas greeting from the enemy. How could we resist wishing each other a Merry Christmas, even though we might beat each other's throats immediately afterwards? So we kept up a running conversation with the Germans, all the while our hands ready on our rifles. Blood and peace, enmity and fraternity. War's most amazing paradox. The night wore on to a dawn, a night made easier by songs from the German trenches, the pipings of piccolos, and from our broad lines, laughter, and Christmas carols. Not a shot was fired."
Several factors combined to produce the conditions that brought on the Christmas truce. By December 1914, the men in the trenches were veterans. They were already familiar enough with the realities of combat that, well, they have lost much of the idealism they had when they were carried into the war back in August. Most longed for an end to the bloodshed. The war they had believed would be over by Christmas, yet there they were, Christmas week, still muddied, still cold, and still in battle. Then, on Christmas Eve itself, several weeks of mild but miserably soaking wet weather gave way to a sudden hard frost, creating a dusting of ice and snow along the front. It made the men on both sides feel that something spiritual was actually taking place. Now, just how widespread the truce was actually hard to say. It certainly was not general. There were also plenty of accounts of fighting continuing through the Christmas season on some sectors. Other men fraternizing with the sound of guns firing nearby. One common factor seems to have been that the Saxon troops, universally regarded as easygoing chaps, most likely were the ones to be involved and may have been the ones to make the first approaches to the British counterparts. According to some reports, one soldier shouted across no man's land, "We are Saxons, and you are Anglo-Saxons. What is there for us to fight about?" Now, the most detailed estimate made by Malcolm Brown of Britain's Imperial War Museum is that the truce extended along almost two-thirds of the British-held trench line that scarred southern Belgium. Even so, accounts of a Christmas truce refers to a suspension of hostilities only between the British and the Germans. The Russians, over on the Eastern Front, still adhered to the old Julian calendar in 1914 and hence did not actually celebrate the Christmas holiday until January 7th. While the French were far more sensitive than their allies to the fact that the Germans were occupying about a third of France and ruling French civilians with some rather, well, distinct harshness. It was only the British sector. Then the troops noticed at dawn the Germans had placed a small Christmas tree along parapets of their trenches. Slowly, parties of men from both sides began to venture toward the barbed wire that separated them, until rifleman Oswald Tilley told his parents in a letter home that literally hundreds from each side were in no man's land, smiling and shaking hands. As expected, communication can be difficult. German-speaking British troops were pretty scarce back in World War I, but many Germans actually could speak English because they were employed in Britain before the war, frequently in many restaurants. Captain Clifton Stockwell, who was an officer with the Royal Welch Fusiliers, found himself occupying a trench opposite the ruins of a heavily shelled brewery. Stockwell proceeded to write in his diary of one Saxon who spoke excellent English, who used to climb in some eyrie of the brewery and spend his time asking, "How's London getting on? How was Gertie Millar and the Gaiety?" and so on. Lots of our men had blind shots at him in the dark, at which he laughed. One night, I came out and recalled, "Who the hell are you?" And once came back the answer, "Ah, the officer. I expect I know you. I used to be head waiter at the Great Central Hotel." Of course, only a few men involved in the truce actually could share reminiscence of London. Far more common was a, well, shared interest in football or soccer, which had been played professionally in Britain for about a quarter century and in Germany since the early 1890s. Now, perhaps it was inevitable that some men on both sides would produce a ball field, freed briefly from the confines of the trenches, and take some pleasure in kicking it about for a while. But according to legend, what followed was something more than that, for the story of the Christmas truce now had its jewel. It's a legend of a match between the British and the Germans, which the Germans actually claim to have won 3-2.
The mist was slow to clear, and suddenly my orderly threw himself into my dugout to say that both the German and Scottish soldiers had come out of their trenches and were fraternizing along the front. I grabbed my binoculars and, looking cautiously over the parapet, saw the incredible sight of our soldiers exchanging cigarettes, schnapps, and chocolate with the enemy. Later, a Scottish soldier appeared with a football, which seemed to come from nowhere, and a few minutes later, a real football match got underway. The Scots marked their goal mouth with their strange caps, and we did the same with ours. It was far from easy to play on the frozen ground, but we continued, keeping rigorously to the rules, despite the fact that it only lasted an hour and that we had no referee. A great many of the passes went wide, but all the amateur footballers, although they must have been very tired, played with huge enthusiasm.
The novelty of getting to know their kilted opposition matched the novelty of playing soccer in the middle of no man's land.
Us Germans really roared when a gust of wind revealed that the Scots wore no drawers under their kilt and hooted and whistled every time they caught an impudent glimpse of one posterior belonging to one of yesterday's enemies. But after an hour's play, when our commanding officer heard about it, he sent an order that we must put a stop to it. A little later, we drifted back to our trenches, and the fraternization ended.
Of course, not every man on either side was actually thrilled with the Christmas truce. An official opposition squelched at least one proposed Anglo-German soccer match. Lieutenant C.E.M. Richards, a young officer serving in the East Lancashire Regiment, had actually been greatly disturbed by reports of fraternization between the men of his regiment and the enemy, and actually had welcomed the return of good old-fashioned sniping late on Christmas Day, just to make sure the war was still on. That evening, however, Richards received a signal from battalion headquarters telling him to make a football pitch in no man's land, and by filling it up the shell holes, and to challenge the enemy to a football match on the 1st of January. Richards recalled that, quote, "I was furious and took no action at all." But over time, his view did mellow. "I wish I'd kept that signal," he wrote years later. "Stupidly, I destroyed it. I was so angry. I would now have liked to have had that would have been a good souvenir of the war. Now, in most places up and down the line, it was accepted that the truce would be purely temporary. Men returned to their trenches at dusk, in some cases summoned back by flares, but for the most part determined to preserve the peace at least until midnight. There was more singing at least one spot where presents were exchanged. George Ede of the Rifles had become friends with a German artilleryman who spoke good English. And as he left, his new acquaintance said to him, "Today, we have peace. Tomorrow, you fight for your country, I fight for mine. Good luck, my friend." Fighting erupted again the next day, although there were reports that some sectors of hostilities were remaining suspended into the new year. It does not seem to have been uncommon for the resumption of the war to be marked with further displays of mutual respect between enemies. In the trenches occupied by the Royal Welsh Fusiliers, Captain Stockwell, he climbed up on the parapet, fired three shots into the air, put up a flag with "Merry Christmas" on it. At this, the opposite number, Hauptmann von Sinner, appeared on the German parapet, and both officers bowed and saluted each other. Von Sinner also fired two shots into the air, then went back down into his trench. The war was on again. There would be no further truce until the general armistice of November of 1918. Many, perhaps close to the majority of thousands of men who celebrated Christmas of 1914 together, would not live to see the return of peace. But for those who did survive, the truce was something that would never be forgotten. The Story of World War I's Christmas Truce, written by Mike Dash, read by Jim Hudson and Sam Scholl. Audio production and adaptation by Kevin Seaman for Auto Radio.